At the end of your life, what will be your legacy? What will you leave behind for future generations? For the world, join the world messenger, Isabella Lundberg. Each week as she brings you a new distinguished guest from the business, sports, or entertainment world to share their success, their struggles, and their lessons. They will share their insights into current hot topics that affect everyone. Isabella facilitates an intimate, vulnerable environment to find the true value of humanity and real leadership. Are you ready for your legacy? The legacy that matters?
If you had a chance and opportunity to speak with subject matter expert on public health, who is not only trailblazing now with George Washington University and taking a much prominent role to shape better solution in public health in not only in DC area, but across the nation, who is US diplomat, foreign service, medical provider, former White House medical officer, as well as Harvard Senior Executive Fellow, what would you ask him? I have a tremendous opportunity today at this episode of Legacy Leader Show to introduce you to someone who really carries the torch of transformation in healthcare space, and obviously his commitment to help our fellow citizens to really understand what is possible and how to navigate the current issues that we're seeing in public health. Without further ado, please welcome Bernard Tony Jr. Bernard, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Isabella. Nice to be here again.
I'm super thrilled that you're able to come and join us again on the Legacy Leader Show because we wanted to, for 2024, as so many disruptions are happening, to really shed some light on this very hot topic. Obviously, you've been involved in military in the past. From there, you transcended in so many other avenues, but you served and continue to serve in ways that I'm just not only impressed, but I also wanted to say one of the few voices that I have tremendous respect that are consistently leading with exceptional leadership and tremendous value. So thank you for all of that. But for everybody that's watching and listening and not familiar a little bit with your background, how did you get here, where you are today? Do you mind walk us through that so that we can then really see why you're doing what you're doing at the moment?
Yeah, thank you for the warm introduction. I don't think I could have done it better myself. My career has made many different turns and different pivots along the way. But long and short, I'm a 21-year Army veteran. I joined the Army at 17 years of age. I did 21 years in the military. Half of that career was heavily revolved around special operations and linguistics. And then I transitioned to being a clinician and worked at the pivotal point, the most culminating point, as a White House medical officer from 2018 to 2022, serving the two most current presidents, former President Donald Trump and President Joe Biden. So I've been a part of those two administrations. And then after my military retirement, I did a number of different things. I did some research in vascular medicine at the National Institutes of Health and had a little bit of a time and experience at the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Veterans Affairs. Currently, I'm a U.S. diplomat and a foreign service medical provider. I mean, what that means is that I provide medical care to U.S. diplomats abroad, working at U.S. embassies. And so for this major second portion of my career, largely I'll be working at different embassies for a couple of years at each embassy around the world for about the next 15 to 20 years or so, God willing. My professional background also includes a lot of public health. And so I did obtain a Master of Public Health at George Washington University. I've been working in a global health and global health engagement space for quite some time in the military. And most recently, I'm now the president of Delta Omega's Omega chapter, which is the Honorary Society of Public Health at George Washington University. So my goal is to shape the conversation and bring in some of the best voices and all the resources and the skill sets that are needed to be able to shape public health as we move forward, particularly after we're coming off the heels of a global pandemic. I want to make sure that we don't lose sight of what's important, because I believe that public health is is what informs just about everything in our lives, where we sleep, where we pray, where we have access to, where we go to school. All those things are public health relevant. And so I think as long as we're focusing on those things, we're elevating all of us to be able to reach our best selves and our best capacity.
Bernard, that is amazing overview and tremendous accomplishments. I really want to, for everybody watching and listening, to have a full sense of what is possible. And you are absolute trailblazer, consistently pushing an envelope and showing us how far-reaching goals can be accomplished, and you are constantly raising the bar. So for my own personal perspective, I'd love to just hear you mention obviously being a linguist on top of obviously being a physician and be able to serve now across the globe in these different environments where U.S. embassies are, and helping members there, as well as obviously through the faculty and everything you've been doing with the George Washington University. So I'm just curious, like, how do you even get a time, and how is all this beautiful components intersecting and colliding together?
Yeah, well, I mean, so, you know, kind of going back to it, you know, the bona fides of my career has always been, how do I help the most amount of people with the resources that I have, right? And so that's what led me to, you know, starting off in the military in a medical sense, working as a medic, and then also doing other things again in linguistics and special operations community. All of that was really working in organizations where we're winning the hearts of minds, and we're trying to bring freedom and democracy and things that people need to be able to live their best lives. You know, going to PA school was something that that was very instrumental in me being able to deliver one-on-one healthcare, to be able to understand how to identify, diagnose, and treat disease. So I was able to certainly do that as a PA, both in the military and in places like the White House Medical Unit. Public health is where I sort of made a more macro perspective look at what's possible with respect to health. I started to realize that you know, as a clinician, I would often sit down with the patient and say something like, well, I need you to, you know, to get your diabetes under control, we're going to have to do some diet and exercise and things of that nature. It was lost on me early in my career that maybe that's not possible for some people. Maybe if you live on a certain part of Washington, D.C., you don't have access to a gym. You may not even have access to healthy grocery stores. They may not be on the bus line if you don't have transportation. And your communities that you live in may not actually be safe for you to exercise on the streets, or if you even have sidewalks. And if you don't have sidewalks, do you have green space to be able to exercise? And so I started realizing that a lot of things that affect our health are not even health related. Again, and that's where I started to really focus on the bigger picture when it comes to public health. How does all of that tie into me being able to be able to affect change, both, you know, in the communities that I work and live in, but also in my family? I'm modeling what I want my children to see. You know, they see the work that I do. They see that dad gets up early and he goes to bed late, but he makes time for us, and I carve out that time to make sure that that they have me in my fullest capacity, and that I'm present. But what I really want to model for them and for the communities that I serve is that we should be looking for servant leadership. We should be servant leaders. And so as long as I'm serving, which that's what I do on a day-to-day basis, then I feel like that I'm helping people, but I'm also modeling what I hope to see in my children as they get older.
How powerful, amazing, intentional that why is, but also impactful, because obviously right now we're seeing things that we didn't even took in consideration. I'm so glad you mentioned that, what it means for each individual and their personal struggles in order to obtain that better quality of health that so many of us take for granted. So speaking of that, and obviously implications on the family and dynamics, right? I'm glad that you also raising a point that how important it is to be available, even though it's such a role that you're holding, finding time for your loved ones and being great role model, not only in external world, but also at your home. From that perspective, do you mind sharing what are you seeing right now, what has happened with the public health and some of the major pain points that we're facing and things that we really have to find good solutions for?
Yeah, I think the most prominent thing that stands out to me is that, the COVID-19 pandemic was horrific, and the amount of destruction and death that it caused, not just in the United States, but globally. One thing that it did do, though, was it unveiled or uncovered many of these social determinants of health, the inequities that exist in our society. When you start looking at stratifying who was most impacted, it was really the people on the margins, the marginalized populations, this lower socioeconomic status individuals, the people in minority communities, people who didn't have access or accessibility to health care to be able to prevent disease, treat disease, and make changes in their lives so they can deal with some of the economic impacts. I'm thinking of people who needed to go to work. There wasn't a telework option for many of these people. And so when you start to look at who's most affected, then you start to figure out targets of opportunity to be able to address public health. And so that's what I believe that we've learned as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. My fear, though, is that maybe we lose some of that traction. When it's very acute and it's on the news every single day, people are very aware. But then after it starts to become, relative remote history for many people, they've since moved on. They focus on other things. My biggest fear is that we lose that initiative to be able to have a concerted effort to be able to address the public health concerns for those people who are most vulnerable in the pandemic. Again, I think that it was a gift and a curse. The curse was obviously the amount of people who were affected, and my heart goes out to all of those people that are still recovering in many ways. But I think it was a gift that now we can see where our vulnerabilities are. Now we can see where we need to have interventions to be able to meaningfully address objectively. And so I think that's where I want to, put a lot of my efforts as a public health professional. But it's also where I think if we were to do a SWOT analysis, it's a threat, that we are a little bit distant away from the acute impacts of the pandemic, and now people's attention have shifted elsewhere. And so my hope is that we can continue on with that same level of work and initiative to ensure that we are continuing to find ways, innovative ways, to improve the lives of people who are otherwise marginalized.
I again, when we think about all of this, as you said, even though attention might be shifted, but the problems are still there. Now that we know more, we need to do better. And I love how proactively you are addressing that. And one of the things that we're also seeing, obviously, currently in our nation and other parts of the world, tremendous increase of mental health issues among other health problems and conditions. And I'm curious, do you have any provisions or any focus and programs right now to address some of those issues? And if you don't mind sharing some of the statistics that you were privy to, that can be really showing again why is this so important and why we need to pay attention and not lose track and understand the cause and effect of it.
Yeah, absolutely. My goal this year, as the incoming president of the Delta Omega Chapter Honorary Society for Public Health, is to really bring in some of the best experts to be able to start formulating ideas and working at the ground level, at the grassroots level, to be able to address some of these issues. I pay attention to a lot of statistics, and I think that people are often, they're sometimes dismayed by the statistics. They don't mean anything. I can tell you right now that depending on what study you look at, about 17 to 22 veterans die by suicide every single day. Today, on average, 17 to 22 people will die by suicide who served in our armed forces. That's disheartening. What that means to me, though, is I've served. I know what those people look like. I've been in army organizations in which I've had members of my unit that died by suicide. Most recently, I had a colleague that I worked with in Hawaii that did not fit the bill of the person who's most at risk, but he also died by suicide. I have a good friend that I served with in Afghanistan. I'm always worried about because when he came back from Afghanistan, both his father and his son died by suicide in the same way. And so those statistics are meaningful to me because I know what they feel like. I know what they look like. I know the pain that they cause. But also realize that we have an increased population of or increased burden of death by suicide in our healthcare workers. You know, healthcare workers are 95% non-physicians. And so the nurses, the technicians, they are all at an elevated risk of as compared to the general population. And so when we start seeing all of these different issues, we start really disaggregating the information and saying, where are the vulnerabilities? What populations are vulnerable and why are they vulnerable? Then that way we can start formulating, you know, very tailored solutions to be able to address and prevent people from going down that pathway. Now I'm a part of the Department of State, and I can tell you that I've never seen better attempts to have a wellness approach, a preventative approach, a comprehensive approach to being able to make sure that we are living healthily from not just from a physical standpoint, but from a mental standpoint as well. But I will say that I'm blessed in that regard, and many people do not have that, and that is the concern. How do we increase accessibility? How do we increase affordability? And how do we destigmatize the seeking of mental health services, which is something that I'm very acutely aware of in many professions?
I'm so glad you mentioned that. Besides, obviously, the current state of things and looking things from obviously former military personnel, but also addressing the healthcare providers. And we're seeing so much shift also in the corporate arena due to not only the layoffs, right, but also the pressures, the stressors, and a lot of uncertainty that increases not only exponential anxiety, the stress, but also for people to really feel like it's no way out. And the stigma approach obviously is the huge one. And I'm curious, mm-hmm. for everybody watching and listening, because I'm sure that everybody has been affected in some ways, directly or indirectly, what would you suggest or recommend in terms of approaches, in terms of the resources, but also in terms of also how urgent it is for leadership of all these organizations to really pay closer attention to?
Yeah, thank you for that. I can tell you that, you know, The U.S. Surgeon General has identified some concerning things. He talks a lot about loneliness, the loneliness epidemic that exists for many of us, particularly after the pandemic. He's also identified social media of note as it relates to our younger population, people who are who have a propensity for having increased depressive symptoms or anxiety associated with exposure to social media and the concerns that, you know, associated with that. You know, reading that data was pretty alarming for me. But what I would say is that we have to look at mental health broadly as we would look at any other form of health. You know, for example, if someone were to go for a run and they sprain their knee, and they tried to do everything they can do. They took a little bit of Motrin, they rested themselves, they iced that knee, they elevated it if it was swollen, they maybe put a compression wrap around it to try to bring down the swelling. They did everything they can do within their means or resources to address that acute injury, but it doesn't get any better. What would most people naturally do from that point? They would then go and seek help from someone to do more thorough evaluation and diagnostics. Mental health should be no different from that. It shouldn't be any different from addressing that swollen knee that maybe doesn't get better with all of your efforts and resources that you have. I think that's from the individual standpoint. I think we have a lot to do from a leadership standpoint in all industries, in all sectors, to ensure that we're destigmatizing the seeking of mental health services. I can tell you that I've had a lot of jobs in my career that, whether it was real or imagined, people did not want to seek care, you know, because maybe it would decrease the amount of opportunities that they would have. Maybe they wouldn't be able to serve at the White House Medical Unit. Maybe they wouldn't be able to get that job as a U.S. Army Special Forces Ranger, you know, Navy SEAL, those types of things. I don't believe that that's true. I know that we have, you know, checks and balances in place to make sure that people are still able to achieve mobility, upward mobility and growth. but that's not what people perceive it to be. And so I think it's our job as leaders to communicate that it is okay. Just as you would go and get evaluated for that swollen knee, we hope that you go and get evaluated for any mental health distress that you may have. And so the burden is on us as leaders to communicate that. Because until we are outwardly communicating that as regularly and as frequently as we possibly can, that culture of stigma will continue to persist. And in those organizations where there is true stigma, I think that we have, you know, those organizations should have a look at themselves to see if they're doing the right things, because obviously, you know, we're moving in the wrong direction in many ways. And I think we have a lot of work to do. That's from a leadership perspective. The other two elements of it is accessibility and affordability. You know, not everyone has access to healthcare. I posted on LinkedIn very recently. If you call 988, you can get acute evaluation, you know, emergent evaluation, get support in that way. But what are we doing on the front end of that? What are we doing before the emergency? That needs to be ubiquitously available for everyone. That access needs to be there. And so I think we need to work in a very concerted effort to ensure that across state lines, we can figure out how to do these things at the federal level and definitely at the state level, where everything doesn't apply to the federal level through the Constitution. States need to figure out ways that way we can provide the resources to everyone at the most affordable rate, and that it's accessible to people. If we don't get those two things right, that affordability and accessibility, the stigma part doesn't even matter, because people aren't seeking out that care anyway, because it isn't an option. So I think, you know, from the very bottom, we need to ensure that mental health services are accessible and affordable.
I love it. And I'm so glad that you look in this holistically and from all the aspects of it in order to create integrated approach. But one thing I'm also hearing, Bernard, and if you can please shed some light from your perspective in conversation, regardless if it's a C-suite executive or someone who is a team member, a lot of times when things you never experienced before, you don't even know, it's like hard to self-assess. And I'm like not sleeping well, I'm stressed out, I'm having anxiety. How do you label, how do you even understand what are you feeling that is something wrong? And as a result, I'm seeing so many people going in overdrive and waiting for way too long, as you said, mm-hmm. to reach that breaking point or bottom line. Where they feel like it's no other point of return or it's too late for most part. So do you mind sharing, is there also a preventative approach to education to identify some of these issues and symptoms? And what would you highlight that would be the good start so that people can really know, like, I really need to do something differently here, or is it time to do X, Y, and Z?
Yeah, you know, I learned, you know, unfortunately, I learned through experience. I give people, we talk a lot about work-life balance. And for a very long time in my life, I didn't have work-life balance. And it was something that was perpetuated and propagated by the leaders that I served under and served with. I'll give you a good example. I once had a leader who would stay very late at work. I mean, she would stay very extremely late. Her children had to be picked up at, I think, at 6 o'clock, and we would stay at work to like 5:55, because it was only a 5-minute drive over to the childcare center from our office. I adopted that. I started staying very late, and even later than she did at the time, because I didn't have the same responsibilities. And then I started noticing that my employees would stay as late. They didn't want to leave until the boss left, because they felt like if they did, they wouldn't be, you know, doing a good job. I think in that way, it starts with us. We have to model what healthy looks like. And, you know, if someone were to say, I don't know whether or not I'm, you know, not living a healthy lifestyle, I'm not sure if I believe that to be true. I think we learn to rationalize things. We learn to justify things. But if we're reflective enough and we start seeing that we're not sleeping well and that our health is not where it should be, or our children aren't inviting us to their activities. These are all things that I experienced, you know, so I know what that is. Those are indicators to say that something isn't right. And even if you don't know exactly what it is, you know, I think that if you were to do a self-assessment to say, am I happy with where I am? Do I feel like I have balance? being honest with myself, in the times that I was out of balance, I can honestly say that I wasn't. I can honestly say that I was checking my phone multiple times a day. There was no off switch for the work that I was doing. There was no off switch for the engagement with my professional career. When I was at my at my daughter's events, I was there, but I was also on my iPhone, so I was kind of nowhere. You know, I think really doing that sort of self-assessment is critical, because then you can look inwardly, but then outwardly to say, am I projecting this on the people that I lead in my organizations? And honestly, I think oftentimes that is the case. You know, if a leader sends an email at 10 o'clock at night and they're receiving responses at 10:05, you know, you're probably projecting that same disequilibrium, you know, across the footprint of your organization. So I think it really starts with yourself. And then if you think that it's pathologic, meaning that it's starting to cause, you know, difficulties in the way you feel, difficulties in maybe not, experiencing life the same way you once did. You're not enjoying things the same way. You're not sleeping well, or maybe you're sleeping too much. If you start to have all of these other symptoms that seem like they're more pathologic or more problematic, then I think that's when you should seek help outside of your own resources and yourself. Because again, it's not just about you, it's about the people that you lead. And if healthy people lead healthy organizations, and I think it works inversely the same way. People who are pathologic, in some way, form or fashion, leading in a way that is detrimental to the organization, then that kind of has a downstream effect. So I'm all about having leaders who are mindful of themselves, because when they're more reflective about themselves, they're more reflective about the people that they lead.
Brilliant. And I love, again, the highlights here. And I think that everybody watching and listening to find it something that not only resonate, but also for them to really rethink. Because right now, we definitely don't see much of that balance. We don't see as many good role models. That's why we really wanted to not only have you back again on Legacy Leader Show, Bernard, but also to really show that it's possible to have amazing trajectory career-wise, but yet still to balance that with your life, with your family, and everything that is important to you, and set those great examples, what that looks like. Which really brings another point I would like you to please address. So, with everything that you've seen, obviously, we also know that right now, because of tremendous changes, people are operating in fear and worry because of layoffs, of economical downturns, and they are pushing harder than they truly can or should. And as a result, we also see those symptomatic problems. But we're also seeing the level of where men don't feel like they could be vulnerable. And we're seeing completely different behaviors between genders. Do you mind addressing a little bit about that too, and validate that it is okay, for men to seek help? And matter of fact, we've seen, as a result, unfortunately, much more predominant suicides due to all of these issues with the men versus women.
Yeah, so I don't have the data with respect to disaggregate the data for gender-based disparities, and the rates of and mortality rates by suicide, but I can tell you that at least in my experience, I've you know in the military I was largely in a male-dominated profession, and so many of the organizations that I served in were certainly much more heavily weighted towards males. I remember one unit that I served in. I don't think we had more than just a couple of women in that organization. I can say that that again, this kind of goes back to stigma. Once from a society and a cultural perspective, we say that this is what strong means and this is what weak means. And once we've started to label people and put them in those two buckets, we've now shut down the conversation of being able to make movement forward. I think the key point that I want to drive home is that there is no, I think the weakness is not seeking care when you need care. I think that is what drives oftentimes people to take that last very terminal result or resort of hurting themselves. It's critical that we have a time and a space for leaders, no matter what their gender is, to be able to take care of themselves. You know, we're doing a disservice to our society. We're doing a disservice to our organizations. We're doing a disservice to our families if we're somehow setting the conditions that that it's not okay to seek care, whether that be because of who you are, but on the role that you have, the position that you have, your gender, all of those things, which we sort of look at as variables in research. Those are confounding variables when it comes to being able to keep people as healthy as they possibly can. I am very concerned about so many different things that are affecting, you know, our society. When I look at gun violence, you know, there's always an element of, you know, some people will say, well, it's having the access to the lethal means. Some people will say, well, this is a mental health issue. I think there's an argument to be made on both sides. I think that if you have mental health distress, but you also have access to lethal means, that's a lethal concoction or formula for someone to unfortunately die by suicide. So I think that we have to address the fact that different populations are affected in different ways. And I think those things need to be, you know, tailored to that population. And if we're talking about C-suite executives that maybe can't spend the time to, you know, drive to a clinic or something like that, we need to look at ways to be able to support those executives and those leaders. Do we expand and offer, you know, access to care by telehealth services? You know, a lot of people, soldiers, other people who are moving all around the world, can't physically go into an office for an hour to talk to, you know, a psychologist, but they do have the time to be able to make that, you know, teleconnect, video connect appointment with the provider while in their office, in their C-suite. So I think we just have to be creative and mindful of how we use all of the different resources that we've learned have worked and that increase accessibility to care. But we have to break down these barriers from whatever construct they may be, whether it be gender, whether it be socioeconomic status, whatever it is. I think we need to make a full court press effort to be able to break down those barriers to care.
Love it. And I'm so glad that you are also looking on flip side, what is working, what is possible, and how can we also make a not only change in the stigma, but also change in approaches and leverage innovative solutions that are available. With that in mind, do you mind sharing some things that you've seen tremendous result that you're super happy and able to achieve for others to really put it kind of in perspective as a result of it?
Yeah. So for me, I'll give you a good example. I, you know, for a long period of time, my life was largely out of balance. I didn't control my own schedule. I allowed myself to be inundated, task saturated almost at every point of every day. Even when I was, you know, kind of just waking up or going to bed, I was still thinking about the things that I need to do or that I haven't done. I think for all of these things to work, you have to give yourself time and space. I am very deliberate and intentional about blocking off time in my schedule for myself. What I do with myself during that time could be any range of things that someone wants to engage in, whether it's meditation, whether it's going to the gym, whether it's reading, just sitting in Barnes and Noble's reading. I have to block that time off because if I didn't, I have so many people who want to, you know, insert themselves into my schedule, and then I become a slave to my calendar, as opposed to the other way around. So I think starting with that intentionality and being deliberate about saying, this is my time for myself, this is my time for my family, and not waver in that. You have to be very clear and deliberate and not waver in that as much as you possibly can, and then building everything else around that. If not, I've learned that, you know, in my professional experience and with serving other people, that they become sort of a slave to their calendar, and everything's placed on their calendar and they have to react to it, and there's not a whole lot of time for themselves. And so we can easily get lost by that. And I see that more so in the senior leaders, where the senior leaders feel guilty that maybe they're taking time off, or they feel guilty that maybe I'm not being as productive as I possibly can. We can go down another rabbit hole about that, but as long as we are decentralizing power, empowering people, giving people the resources that they need to be able to be successful, and modeling a healthy behavior within ourselves, I think that gives people the permission, and it affirms people to do the same. And until we do that within ourselves, I don't think it's possible for the people who work for us to do that. And if we're looking at productivity, you know, if we were to take this back to what does it mean for the bottom line, when you have people who are distressed, when you have people who are depressed, when you have people who are anxious, they're not as productive as you would like for them to be, you know? And so you have to set the conditions as a leader so that they can be productive. And that starts with you as a person and as a leader.
I love that, specifically because right now the lines are so blurred. Where is the responsibility from leadership and us as individual contributors, right? And it's like, where's that gray area? It's like, it's again, between coach and coachee or mentor and mentee, it's all of those lines are being now looked at from different perspectives, but ultimately, as you said, drawing healthy boundaries. I love how you eloquently explain that and starts with you first, and then obviously ripple effect that it's being created with everybody else. But I'm curious, with the ripple effect that you're already creating in some headways in 2024, and with not only your new roles and but also obviously the vision, what were some of the things that you would love to share that you feel so proud of it and super excited, so we can be also future focused? Because from future focused leadership, I want everybody to see what it also takes to be that proactive leader as you are, in addition to be servant leader and then connect the dots.
Yeah, so what I do is, you know, for me, this year I completed the Harvard Senior Executive Fellowship. That was very critical for me, to someone who's been in leadership for quite some time now, to be able to have a critical lens and challenge my leadership beliefs. I've made some changes on, you know, the way that I think about things, the way that I approach things. And I think that that was my way of being able to say, I don't know it all. I can always be refined, and I want to be shaped by other leaders around me. And that fellowship allowed me to be able to do that. I think it was very critical as I get ready to go over to my first U.S. embassy overseas in Turkmenistan and lead that health unit over there, to be able to work through the different cultural barriers and linguistic barriers and look at those barriers as not barriers, but really opportunities for growth and development. And so that's what I did in 2024 as I get ready to head overseas, amongst a number of other things. But I would say for other leaders, always be looking for that next opportunity to shape yourself as a leader. Always be willing to have a critical lens on who you are, how you lead, and are you doing things the way that you intend for them to be done? And if you can find opportunities to do that, I think that is the key to ongoing development, ongoing learning. And as one of the leaders in my Harvard Senior Executive Fellowship program once said, he said, I'm not a lifelong learner. I'm a lifelong seeker. And so I'm always seeking that knowledge to be able to make myself better and the people around me. And for the leaders who listen to this, and for everyone who listens to this, I think that should always be our aim, is to, you know, to get just 1% better every single day. And finding ways to do that in a very creative and innovative way is going to look different for different people. For me, I find these, you know, sort of programs and leadership opportunities and fellowships to help shape the way that I lead. But that might not always be the case for everyone. Maybe it's finding a good mentor that's always going to be by your side as you kind of go through certain phases of your life. Maybe you have a range of mentors, and I recommend that as well. Maybe it's your faith. Whatever it is, always be looking for that next opportunity to make yourself 1% better every day.
Love it. What a great advice and great attitude. And I love the differentiation between lifetime learner versus lifetime seeker. And you are definitely the curious, amazing mind. And first of all, congratulations and accomplishments. That's amazing. But also, I'm just wanted to know what's left in the bucket list. Seems like you obtained and achieved so much. It's like, what is next? What is left, Bernard?
There are a lot of things that are to come. But like I said, it's all about pacing myself, and it's all about balance. My focus right now is my family. My lovely family is, they're out in South Korea right now enjoying themselves. They've been there for about a month or so now. They're getting ready to come back, and we're getting ready to go on this journey together. My focus is largely going to be on focusing on the development of my children and helping them get adjusted to living in different countries around the world. Linguistically, I'm ensuring that they have what they need to be able to learn these different languages, and culturally making sure they are prepared to be able to immerse themselves in different cultures. My goal from this point is to make my family as much of global citizens as I possibly can, because I think that it doesn't stop at our cities and our state lines and or even our country borders. We're all in this together, and so I want them to have visibility, have empathy, have insight on the benefits and even the struggles that many people have all around the world. I think that's how I make the next generation of leaders better. And I'm hoping that has an exponential impact and effect. So that's really my focus from this point forward.
Thank you for listening to Legacy Leader Show. If you enjoyed the content and had a positive experience, then please leave us a positive rating. In addition, leave us a positive review whenever you are listening on whatever platform there might be. Make sure your friends and family also know about the benefit and value that we provide and what we have to offer. Cheers.